lack the ability to cope with what's going on in their life. And so that's all of us, right? Any one of us can end up being pushed around on this continuum if the circumstances are right. So that's what I'd like you to keep in mind when we talk about this, that we're not talking about us and them when it comes to the subject of mental health. That's all of us. We just fall in different places on the continuum at various times.
Before we get into the questions, just one question that I didn't ask you earlier. Would you be able to just introduce yourself really quickly? And I'm not looking for credentials, but just what do you do, and how are you involved in the mental health field?
So I'm the director of ethics and mental health, ethics and spiritual care at Waypoint. I've been involved with Waypoint on and off for the better part of 35 years. So I have a long history working with mental health.
His name is Glenn Robitaille.
And my name is Joel Robitaille, and I am a case manager at Wendat Community Programs. We have a support for independent living program where we help people live in the community and build up their life skills, as well as a housing registry, and then we do brief service for people who walk in. And so I've been working there for almost 6 years.
I'm Zoe Hilton. I'm a registered psychologist, and I've worked at Waypoint for 27 years. Most of that time has been in research, so although I've done some clinical work, mostly I'm trying to keep up with the current evidence base on mental disorders and other things.
I'm Bruce Castleman. I volunteer on the Patient Family Council at Waypoint, and I also volunteer on the Ethics Committee at Waypoint.
Great, thank you. So my first question, and just I've asked a couple of people to answer each of these questions, and others will be free to weigh in as well. But the first question is, why is mental health being important? You know, is it really an issue, or is it something, you know, what was the agency that you say created this? Mental Health Commission of Canada. That sounds like the kind of group that might try and make some of the issues so they get more funding, because something, things like that happen. So is it really an issue, or is it just something that's kind of been a media creation that's kind of pushed, or is it something that we're just more aware of because we're close to Waypoint? You know, what is it really an issue?
Okay. I'm fielding this question. So I think mental health week is important because it continues to normalize mental health as something that touches us all. Living in the world that we do, for many of us, a world that we recognize to have a lot of beauty and love, and yet we see and experience so much pain and suffering, pressure, fear, and trauma. We're all left to process the good and the bad. At Wendat, many of our clients have grown up in a home that wasn't loving or supportive, and in many cases their situations were abusive, but they conceded love they missed out in other people's lives. It's no wonder that our inner conflict produces both physical and mental health symptoms, whether we're talking about headaches and migraines, anxiety and stress, depression, gastrointestinal issues, muscle soreness, diseases, or debilitating mental illness. And of course, there are genetic and environmental factors that contribute to mental health problems as well. This is an issue that spans the globe because none of us are immune. Everybody suffers some form of mental health, has some type of mental health issue. It just might not be on a scale that requires treatment. This is part of the reason we hear so much about meditation, yoga, cognitive behavioral therapy, and other techniques and therapies that allow us to manage our problems and help those who are close to us manage our problems.
Thank you. Okay, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, it's important because I think it's important to know and understand that every family, bar none, has a mental health history. Okay, so it's okay to talk about it.
The only thing I would add is kind of like the normalizing of mental health issues in conjunction with the mental health continuum, I think is very helpful because it can help us all talk about our own experience with various aspects of mental health, whether it's our own or people close to us, but at the same time, not like to recognize that there are more extreme situations. So we can't say, oh, you know, well, I know somebody who had this and they got better really quickly, so why don't you, kind of thing. So I think it helps place it all in context.
Yeah, the other reason is that mental health is the most underfunded area of healthcare in Canada. You know, the reason Clary Hughes did her big ride to raise money and raise visibility is because we haven't yet convinced the funding agencies of our country that the social determinants of health push health care at every level. So if we don't take care of mental health, it doesn't just affect the mental health budget. It affects all of it. Mm-hmm. All of it.
Great. Just so you know, my mind is already like going because when Joel, you're talking about the different physical symptoms, I'm thinking back to a time where I had a physical symptom due to anxiety stuff, and I just never crossed my mind to think of that as a mental health thing, which it absolutely was, and it's sort of one of those obvious things, but just, thank you. So as followers of Jesus, we look to Scripture to help point us toward Jesus and His way, and I think Zoe, I was going to ask you, and Jana was on to answer this one as well. She's not able to be here, so others can jump in. Is mental health something the Bible even talks about?
I think the Bible does talk about mental health and mental illness. And I think there are some good examples of that. Trying to remember the location in the New Testament. The man with the unclean spirit. I think mm-hmm. the description of that is pardon?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's a really good description of how that man was suffering, and the outward behavior. It was obviously a very extreme example, but the outward behavior and how it upset the people around him. And you know, it even describes him cutting himself, which I think is really neat to see. And I also think that you know, we see Jesus having mental anguish as well and despair on the cross. But I think that all these examples, they're not there really to tell us about mental illness, to help us understand it. They're there to tell us about God and what God did and how God suffered with us.
Yeah, the reality of it, not the solution.
Right.
Okay, that's great. I just can't help think of, you know, you read through the Psalms and you're faced with it.
Can I point something out there?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, the Bible is not a medical textbook. So a lot of times things that really would be diagnosed today as a mental health issue are attributed to spiritual forces and things like that. So when we're reading through Scripture, there's actually a lot of mental health issues happening that today, if they were seeing someone who was qualified to diagnose, would see it differently than it's being recorded. But, you know, people record things in the context of their time,
yeah.
And that's what it looked like to them. So there's a lot of mental health.
Okay. So, Glenn, question for you that I know you've wrestled with. If we believe that Jesus is the hope for the world, should we not be able to trust that He will heal those with mental illness? Why should our focus as Christians go beyond, you know, praying for people, evangelization, like praying that God will heal those who have mental illness?
So, I'm actually in the field of mental health because of that very conflict. I made my first trip to the mental health center, Penetanguishene, at the time, along with Judy and Ken and my wife and a number of other young people at Knox Presbyterian at the time, to do some music on what is now our admission assessment program, and met a guy there that I continued to visit quite regularly. But in those early days, I went because I believed that the gospel could dispel mental illness like WD-40 disperses water. And so I was there trying to bring that dynamic to the people who suffered with mental health issues at that waypoint, to the degree that I almost got barred and kicked out of the facility. So that was my focus. But what I found is that all of my preconceived ideas did not work in that context. Trying to do it in that way did not work. Then I came upon a book written by a guy named David Siemens. He was at the time a professor at Asbury Seminary. He wrote a book called Healing for Damaged Emotions that just kind of lit me up and opened up my mind. And what I came to realize is that, no, the gospel doesn't cure mental illness. But what does often, and then I think Joel was touching on this, is the relationship that you have with people. So the goal for me was then to become a conduit expressing the love of God to the people with whom I was working. That's the healer. So, you know, if healing's going to occur, it's going to occur in a context where people are feeling valued and appreciated. And let me tell you, if someone's an inpatient in a facility, a lot of them don't even get visits from family. You know, they struggle with that. So, you know, having that human connection, people connecting with them in that way, that's the healing force. And, again, And we, in recovery, we don't talk about recovery or healing being you no longer have a mental illness. It means you're able to, with whatever disorder you have, live the maximum amount of mental health or your ability to cope. And so what assists with that is that connection, that human connection. And that's why it's so important, not only when you're working in the field of mental health within a facility, but, you know, that's what the church should be, too. It should be a place where people get that human connection because that's the healing force.
Great. Thank you. Anyone have anything to add on that? My mind automatically goes to the parallel with the physical reality. Most of us have no issues, qualms, pairing prayer and doctors. So beyond the specific mental health struggle, like we talk about where people are on the continuum, and we can talk about the mental health realities. But what are, in our community specifically, what are some of the things that those who would be farther down on the minimal mental health scale, what are some of the things that corresponds with the mental health struggle? What issues are they facing? And I know, Joel, you work with this on a regular basis. Bruce, you see some of this. What do you see that sometimes comes along with the minimal mental health?
Well, I work with people who have a severe mental illness, mm-hmm. so I can speak better to that because that's who actually walk through our doors.
Yeah.
And so we basically work with people who have schizophrenia, they're bipolar, or they have borderline personality disorder. And so in order to be part of our program, they basically have to have a psychosis of some type.
Okay.
And so I would say that severe mental illness can make it difficult for people to work. So I'm going to stay talking about on the severe side. In what I see, so these people are stretched financially and often live in lower-end apartments and rooming situations. They have addictions or have impulse control issues. Their money can be gone within the first few days of receiving their checks. This means that they're living all month broke and constantly losing their housing and not eating well. I know quite a few of our clients fall victim to lottery tickets and other forms of gambling. In general, I find that people with severe mental illness have a fear of losing control in public and ending up back in the hospital, which means they're always vigilant of themselves and tend not to want to put themselves in situations where they're at risk. And it's difficult for them to get over this fear. Other people like the security that the hospital offers, and they'll try to find ways to get back in. I find that many of my clients have identity issues. Who am I and how do I reconcile the life I had pre-illness with the one I have now? People with schizophrenia often have problems understanding people and communicating with others. They often tell me that they watch TV and have a hard time knowing what's going on. I think this is why many of them tend to be loners or are skeptical of joining groups. I also find that some people with severe mental illness write themselves off as being unworthy of having a relationship. It's quite sad because I think all of my clients should be able to experience the joy of having a loving relationship. Many people with severe mental illness do not have supportive families, which really contributes to their loneliness and feeling that they're alone in the world. They also grapple with the understanding of God's role in their condition, so in some cases they don't know where they stand with God, or they can even view their illness as some type of divine punishment. Many of them believe that God can heal them of their mental illness, and they have this expectation, which sets them up for disappointment. So money, food, housing issues, addiction, self-confidence, loneliness, relationship issues, sometimes sexual issues, issues of identity, hopelessness, in some cases legal issues, worthlessness, religious insecurity, and even medication side effects can all be a part of normal life for people I work with, along with awful mental health symptoms such as problems with their thoughts, voices, hallucinations, delusions, severe depression, paranoia, and so on.
Wow. There's a big part of me when I hear that list. That fear, anxiety, concern about worth and whether or not we're worthy of being loved, and just that it very quickly moves to empathy, just because I think a lot of us can relate to a lot of those feelings, and you can just figure out how to cope a little bit. It gets back to your talking about it's coping, right? So yeah, empathy starts to crop up when you understand. So when I walk past somebody on the street, you know, if my first thought is, well, just don't get a job.
Mm-hmm.
That's a just slight oversimplification.
Yeah. Many people have that view.
Yeah. Do you have some bad news?
I was going to say on the minimal side, mm-hmm. I mean, when somebody has a severe mental illness, that's obvious.
But in the most cases, we hear people, they struggle with their mental illness. Well, it's not a struggle. For most people, it's just Monday to Friday, right? Because where you might see somebody and say, well, clearly they got a problem, that person might not know they have a problem because it's Monday to Friday to them. Their life is normal, right? It doesn't seem out of the ordinary to them. And so what anybody needs, whether they have mental illness or not, is all the things that everybody needs: shelter, security, food, some money to operate, and most of all, not to be stigmatized, right? And that's the hard one for society. And that's why we're here having a talk, is because it's okay in this day and age to let that go. As we've said here, it permeates society in a much greater way than anybody really knows. And that's why I said earlier, every family, bar none, has a mental health history. And it might go from, like we talked about the spectrum, from, severe to not so severe. But, no family gets away without, being affected in some way. Maybe you don't have a mental illness. Maybe your mother does. Maybe you're affected by that. And so this is how it rolls through society. So if I could make, the biggest point I want to make is, for most people, it's not a struggle. They just live with it because it's normal to them. Right?
I'm going to add another question in here. For those of us for whom our mental health reality has become normal, maybe some people have alluded to us that counseling might be available or something like that, but we're afraid of the stigma. What advice would you give for those who are afraid of the stigma, who are afraid of not wanting to be able to say, I have it all together? What advice do you give those of us who are in that camp?
Nobody has it all together.
And I would say that if somebody reached out for help, they would find the people who are there to offer help are not going to be stigmatizing.
Mm-hmm.
They work with this all the time. They work with their own issues, and they're fully aware of the, if I can use the word handicap, the handicap that stigma has on to whatever people are dealing with. And for people who are really not ready to speak out or even tell somebody close to them, there are some really good websites available.
Okay.
There's a lot of bad information out there, but there's some really good websites, like CAMH, the Center for Mental Health, Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, has some good information on the website. There's an Anxiety BC website. There's some good information and tools that anybody can access, whether it's for yourself or for somebody close to you.
Would we be able to, this is a quest for whoever, would you be able to send me some of those resources and tools, and we will get a posting on our website that will share those and make them available for people?
Yeah, this is something my wife gave me years ago that I've been using with great success to tell people when they're struggling with an issue like that. Counseling is a gift you give yourself.
Okay.
And because that's what it really is. I like to, when couples struggle with going to a counselor and paying money, I say, well, if you think counseling is expensive, try divorce.
Yeah, go ahead.
The other thing that's important to know about stigma is, if we have a bias, right? The stigma is greatest on ourselves. So when you talk about going for help, the reason people struggle with that is because the stigma, that we all call it, is greatest on ourselves. We're hardest on ourselves than we are on other people.
Thank you. Just getting back to the overall conversation, how do we love people well? How can we love well our neighbors who, whether they know it or not, our family members, our those around us, how can we love well in the midst of mental health struggles? Any advice?
I think at an individual level, there's lots of things. I think the first thing is praying for a genuine desire to love people who seem different from us. But also, I think it takes a lot of patience when we don't understand what somebody's going through, and we don't want to assume that we know what somebody's going through. And trying to learn a little bit about, like, if the person has been open about their whatever mental health label they want to give it. If the person's been open, then trying to find out some good information about that so you can try to understand and just be patient and loving and keep finding ways to include people.
Great, thank you.
I'd say if you're talking to someone who has mental health struggles, talk to them like you would talk to anybody else and try to show that you're non-judgmental in your words and mannerisms. You may want to build a relationship with people you encounter regularly, such as a neighbor or someone you encounter at work. Really listen to them if you become comfortable. You may want to share things about your life with them. Be dependable, someone they can talk to and count on. I'd also suggest including them in things, for instance, like a barbecue or an event. They may turn you down, but someday they may take you up on it. My clients will often comment on me being non-judgmental, which tells me this means something to them. In my role, I have to challenge my clients in order to help them break out of their shell, search for meaning, be less judgmental towards themselves, improve their finances, or question fixed beliefs, but it's always done in a tone and manner that respects their experiences and point of view. If you know someone with mental illness, offer to buy him or her a coffee and talk to them. Many of them enjoy a free coffee and interaction. If you have a business, maybe give them a few hours to someone who can use some extra cash. This is something I've seen other business owners do, and this truly changes lives. But most of all, I would recommend talking to them like you would talk to anybody else. You may even want to self-disclose parts of your life with them as you build a relationship. This reinforces that they're the same as anyone else and just have to deal with their own particular issues like everyone else.
Thank you.
Yeah, the one tool I use, and I use it every day, is validate. Joel mentioned that. Validation. You can always find something to validate. You don't have to agree, but when someone risks saying something or sharing something, always be listening for something to validate. So that's kind of my lens. We don't have to fix everything. Validation is a way that opens up the relationship wider and gives you more opportunities to have conversations. So that's if you want one tool when you're working with someone or when you're befriending or listening to someone with a mental health crisis, listen with that lens. But can you validate what they're saying?
Great. Thank you very much. The last question that I have here is deals with what advice do you would give friends and family of those who are dealing with significant mental health illness? Specifically, my concern is that sometimes we can get so wrapped up with wanting to love and help that it can burn us out. It can impact us and drop us into a crisis because we're so focused on that. And so what advice do you have for balancing loving others and appropriate self-care? Go on, Bruce.
It's difficult when you are dealing with family members, adult family members, not children, adult family members. In my case, it was my mother and now my son, okay? So there's two different, scenarios going on there. But what I've learned over the years is that the only thing I can do is always let my loved one know that hope. I have hope. I will always have hope for them. And that's the biggest thing. Let them know that your love will never die. Your hope will never die. But we don't have control over other people with mental illness, right? So having said that, then it becomes very important to be able to separate yourself from the person who has the family member who has the mental illness, because it's very easy to develop a codependent relationship with them where it becomes then, I can't be all right unless they're all right, right? And that's not a healthy way to live. My happiness or anyone's happiness cannot be dependent on what somebody else says or doesn't say or does or doesn't do. Then it comes down to a case where we have to manage our own mental wellness. Okay? It's not an illness, it's a mental wellness. Depends how you look at it. So then when we empower ourselves to say, okay, I owe it to myself to look after my mental wellness, because then my spirit permeates everyone around me. So if I'm not well mentally, I can't affect other people in a positive way. Does that make sense? Everyone is responsible, in my opinion, everyone is responsible to do what they can to manage their own mental wellness, whether that's dropping the stigma and saying, I'm going for help, you know, for myself. Maybe I can't do anything for my loved one who isn't doing well. And in doing that, when you're able to, let's speak for myself, when I'm able to gather my own self up and make my own self healthy, then I'm able to love so much better, right? And so one other thing to say about that, it depends on what the mental illness is, right? My mother, I never knew her diagnosis. I just remember as a kid going visiting her many times at, so it wasn't called Waypoint then, but same place. And then when my son, when he was about 19, he became unwell with schizophrenia. So it's been a big learning curve for my wife and I to learn how to keep our own sanity and keep our own heads above water. I'm losing my thought here. Mental illness. Most people, or what's obvious to me is, it's like alcoholism, okay? In the sense that most people would view alcoholism, somebody who has an alcohol problem would be the derelict on the street. Well, that's only 1%, right? The other 99% get up and go to work every day. That's the same with mental illness, you know? Most people with mental illness get up and go to work every day and do what they have to do.
Anything to add to that?
Well, I would just say, you know, building on what Bruce said, in my experience, families who are under-involved or over-involved, you know, pretty much lead to poor results for the actual person struggling with it.
I would just add on the self-care piece, there are times for everyone where you have to put self-care to the side and your focus goes towards caregiving and you're getting out of balance.
Yes.
So that happens, and any new mother can tell you that. So, you know, those things happen. But the thing to keep in mind is that you can only do that as long as you have emotional reserves. Once you get rid of your emotional fat and start burning emotional muscle, that's when burnout starts to occur.
Yeah.
So you can delay it, but you cannot just not do it.
Okay.
So you can put it on hold for a while, but that self-care, usually you have to think about it as being a balance. The amount of energy that goes out, it has to come back in. So you might have to delay it sometimes because of circumstance, but if you don't do that good self-care, you know, eventually you're not going to be able to help anyone else.
I'm going to borrow that mic from you and take it out so that people can ask questions. Any questions, Gary?
I wanted to say especially a big thank you to Glenn for stuff in the past, in the early 2000s. And that stigmatism, I was mentioning that to Bruce before he went up there. I didn't know he was going to be up there. But so much stigmatism to mental health. And being on the volunteer list in the early 2000s, you certainly learned one heck of a lot of the comments that you people made. I'll never forget one woman that was on that volunteer list when I was back there. I got a few things I remember distinctly. One is her husband used to work at the hospital, and people used to ask her where her husband worked. She'd say, at the nut house. Well, after she was on that volunteer list, she said she quit altogether that. She started to understand it. And the funny part, but not funny, I learned the word normal is only on a washing machine. But the other things in there, the facts that you learn back there, being on that volunteer list, I even heard that it could be reduced from 1 in 5 to 1 in 4. 1 in 100 in Canada, the size of Canada, is schizophrenic. Something I didn't believe in before. I always said at one time, many years ago, I could kill somebody else but never kill myself. 1 in 7, I thought about suicide. These facts that I learned about Glenn back in the early days have stuck with me ever since the early 2000s. And that looking after yourself, you see yourself slip when you're dealing with somebody else. Like I was been involved with somebody else in a mental health situation. And in dealing with that, your mental health does go downhill when you do have the self that what you people mentioned was looking after self mental health. Because yours goes downhill if you don't look after it like that. And this is experience time. So anyway, thank you very much, Glenn Robitaille.
Any other questions?
Just wondering, we're talking about fixing all of these symptoms that people have. My question would be, when small children are born, we assume they're normal. I don't know whether people are predisposed to mental illness or more of a proactive approach. Is it preventable in many cases, and what can be done so that it doesn't become the big problem that it is?
There is a strong, what they call a genetic component to a lot of mental illness, especially the more serious mental illnesses, such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and so on. But in any situations, there are things that are protective as children are growing older. Being able to provide them with some stability, being able to provide a child with, you know, if there's at least one loving, stable person in that child's life, that can really give them a lot of resilience as they go through life. And as some things start to appear, like perhaps a lot of anxiety or a low mood showing up, in childhood, there are tools that can be, there are skills that can be provided to children from an early age that can help them with that coping and keep that mental health side up.
Okay, cool.
Hi, I'm glad I know you struggled with this, and I think I talked with Zoe a bit about it. Since I started working with your team, I really came to understand the importance of spirituality in mental wellness, and I really helped Julius and you know, the other chaplains promote singing mostly. It really seems to lift a lot of people up, but there's a double-edged sword, and you talked on that, this feeling of not being worthy enough, or like, so I believe in God, so why has God let these people have this illness? Or am I worthy enough of God's love? So when you have a mental illness, everything can be black and white. And even as a caregiver, when I get close to burnout, it's that, and I tend to question God. So how do you help people promoting spiritual wellness without, while cushioning this self-doubt? Sorry, I couldn't phrase it.
Well, as you were mentioning, when people are spiritual, generally it's their go-to coping strategy. So if people are spiritual, that's where they go first. So that faith perspective can either be helpful or harmful. And when it's harmful, it's connecting to either shame or guilt most of the time, and fear. So shame, guilt, and fear are the three big drivers of what would be spiritual thinking, spiritual beliefs that are not helping a person with their mental health. That's not only true for people who are struggling with a mental health issue. Those are the things that rob people of the joy of their life in Christ. You know, if your lens for God is fear, guilt, or shame, you're not. It's not going to be helpful to you when you need it. And it's more of a the view of God that comes with that is not a healthy one. So a lot of the assessment that we do with people is to figure out whether or not those beliefs that they have. We don't try to change their beliefs, but what we do want to do is help them to figure out whether or not that view of God that they have is helping them with their mental health. You know, I like to give them the check. You know, if I believe this to be true, what am I saying God is like? Because every belief says something about who God is. And people, when they look through that lens, find that often their view of Christ is more like Adolf Hitler than it is Jesus, right? So that's the good question to ask. If you're believing something and it's producing fear, guilt, and shame, well, if what you're believing is true, then what does that mean God is like? So that's a helpful corrective that people can use to check.
Something else that would go with that that I've helped to explain to people who ask that question. You know, why would I be inflicted with this? Would be that your illness, the organ that is involved is your brain. Well, if you had diabetes, the organ involved would be your pancreas, or you know, if you had a broken leg, it would be your leg. But it's just one malady, and it just so happens with mental illness that the organ affected is the one making all the decision making. Right? So it makes it hard.
Is there one more really pressing question? This will be the last question. I'm going to get you to ask that into the mic just to make sure everybody can hear. Thank you.
Glenn, I wanted to know if you could give a simple example of how you validate somebody.
Well, when you're validating, you don't say that something that is obviously delusional is not delusional. That's not kind of you validate something of the emotion behind it. So I might say, wow, that sounds really painful. Or, wow, that sounds really important. Right? So what you're trying to do is you're trying to find something in what they're saying that you can give some validation to. And often if you look at through that lens of the emotion piece of it, that's the quick and dirty method. There are, of course, more elaborate methods if you're having a longer conversation. But in every conversation, that's what I'm looking for. I have people who walk through that I see on a regular basis, who sometimes even will say really defamatory things to me. And, you know, instead of just walking by, I say, wow, I can see you're very angry, right? I validate it. Now, or I can see why that would be something that could be making you angry.
That was a great question. Thank you. Is there a chance that you guys would be available just to stay up at the front, that if people have other questions, so that after the service you'd be able to talk with them? Okay, so they'll be around here. So afterwards, if you have other questions, please feel free to come and talk to them. Would you just join me in giving them some thanks for their time this morning? Thank you very much. You guys can come on down. The music team is going to come back up and lead us in a song.
As they come up, I wanted to say before the last song that I chickened out was that is one, the last song we did, All My Hope is, for me, one of my coping skills when I'm dealing with my anxiety and I've dealt with depression is music, and that All My Hope is a song that I can take on and I can sing it anywhere, it can help lift my spirits, and there's many songs like that, and we're going to be singing Your Grace is Enough, and it's not meant to be trite. God's grace is enough for all of us. So we want to stand together and close our service.